This here is going to talk about unleavened bread and in a little bit more of a indirect manner, as you'll see from the beginning. As you think about the scriptures, where is the first place that God talks about the days of unleavened bread? Where is the first place in the scriptures where God talks about the days of unleavened bread? And in actuality, it hints at the days of unleavened bread, and that's found in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. Genesis chapter 1, verse 14. Now, if you read the New King James Version, Genesis 1, 14 says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." And when you look at the way that that's been translated, it's not very clear. You would never, ever conclude from the way it's written in the King James Version that there's actually a tie-in with the Holy Days. And, you know, from just an English point of view, it's the translation isn't bad. But if you look in a couple of other more modern translations, like today's English version, there it says, "Let there be lights in the sky to separate day from night and to show the time when days, years, and religious festivals begin." So that more modern translation takes in the information that's given there that would cause you to conclude about that it's referring to religious festivals, of which the days of unleavened bread would be religious festivals. So anyway, as you, another translation that makes that same point is the contemporary English version. In Genesis 1 verse 14, it says, "I command lights to appear in the sky and to separate day from night and to show the times, the time for seasons, special days and years." So it recognizes that one of the words there that is used to translate it in a way that refers to religious festivals or special days is a particular Hebrew word that points to that. So what we find is that as God created the earth, God put lights in the sky, and one of the reasons he does is to mark sacred times or signs for festivals. And as I said, the King James Version misses this entirely. And but you can see these other translations point to the fact that it's talking about the holy days. In fact, if you look at the word that's translated as religious festivals, the word is Moedim, M-O-E-D-I-M, Moedim. And the English translation of the word would be more accurately translated as appointed times. And the holy days are God's appointed times. So the essence of it is that when God made the lights in the sky, he placed them in a pattern that allowed man to note God's appointed times. And he could do so by observation, but observation is unreliable because as you're observing the patterns in the sky, you can't always see it. You know, like it was hard for us to see the eclipse when that passed by and because it was cloudy. So the clouds came in and made it difficult to see. Other people were in places where they could clearly see the eclipse. So our observation is undermined by clouds and storms and things like that. But you can also, because there's a regular pattern in the sun and the moon and their orbits, they're in a pattern that is by which you can calculate, and therefore you can know the times and the seasons, and you're able to calculate them. And we have That's what we rely on as far as the calendar is concerned, is calculation. So please, as we go through this, please remember the English words appointed times. The study will go on for a little bit better than 30 minutes, but I just keep those words appointed times in mind. As you think about appointed times, you might think of them in light of a doctor's appointment. You know, when you, you know, today, sometime in the past, I had made an appointment to go see my heart doctor. So today I had that appointment and they set up a new appointment. And due to modern technology, then I'll start getting later on reminders of my appointment, and they'll be checking to make sure that I'm going to show up for the appointment. And so if you have a, like today, my appointment was at 1:30, so they're expecting that you would be there by 1:30. And that's how doctor's visits work. They set up an appointment, and the doctor commits to being there, and you as the patient commit to being there. And it seems that a lot of people don't worry too much about making their appointments, and they'll just miss the appointment and not show up at all, not communicate at all. So a number of doctor's offices have begun charging people for not showing up. So they expect you to communicate with them if you can't make it, and they can rearrange the schedule, but just not to show up, then they have actually begun to charge people for that. So we find from the scriptures in Genesis chapter 1 that God has appointed times, and we call those appointed times holy days. If human beings don't show up for the appointment, what does God do? God's going to be there. God set the appointment. God will be there on that day, just like he's there every seventh day, and he's there on the 14th of Nisan, he's there on the 15th of Nisan, he's there on the 21st of Nisan, he's there all the way through. He's there on Pentecost, he's there at all of the appointed times that he's established. They're important. They're God's holy days, and God is always there because they're important parts of his plan. So let's look at a simple application of this reality. Jesus Christ was crucified at an appointed time on the day of Passover. It wasn't the day before Passover. It wasn't the day after Passover. In fact, we are told that he died at the ninth hour, a specific hour on the 14th. Let's go to Matthew chapter 27 and look at verse 45. Matthew 27, verse 45. There it says, "Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So there came a point where Jesus's life came to an end, and Jesus cried out to the Father, and that signaled the end. You know, it says in the scriptures, it is finished. He had finished the work that God had given him to do. In Matthew chapter 27, verse 50, it says, "And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." So he had died at the ninth hour. That is 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the day of Pentecost, a day of, excuse me, day of Passover. So he died, his life came to an end, and they came to take him down from the stake, and then they put him into the tomb, and the 3 days and three nights began to run on the clock. So as you think about this and the death of Christ, and it's taking place at a very specific time, why is that significant? As you think about Christ dying at the ninth hour, why does that have a significance for all of us? The significance is that in the ninth hour in the temple, the high priest took the official lamb, the official Passover lamb, slit the lamb's throat, and caught the blood in the basin. And it was, you see, an appointed time of God when Jesus would die. And as his life came to an end, then he paid the price for my sins and your sins. And so something very momentous took place with his death. So all of this suggests to us that God did not invent the Passover when he was bringing Israel out of Egypt. We may have thought that, but that's not when God invented the Passover. The Passover was already one of God's appointed times back in the Garden of Eden. That was already one of God's appointed times. It did not come into being in the time of Israel coming out of Egypt. It was already in place because God's plan from before the foundation of the world was for the Son of God to die for the sins of mankind. So he was to be the Passover lamb. So as you think about that, that was already in place before Israel ever went, was enslaved in Egypt, and before they were ever freed from Egypt. It's something interesting just to consider about how things unfolded. Now, most of us are familiar with a second reference. That reference is found in the book of Acts. And it's a similar type of reference. And it tells us that about a specific day in Acts chapter 2. It says, when the day of Pentecost was fully come, it didn't come a day early, and it didn't come a day late. It came on a specific day, the day of Pentecost, when it came in its fullness. Interestingly, if you go back to our former organization, the leaders of that organization were teaching us that these appointed times were only for the Jews. They have no application to you and me as Christians. And so they emphasized that those days were not Christian obligations, which we, as we've gone back and studied it, reject that thinking. And we feel that the days do apply to us as God's people. So if you think about it, you would have to conclude, if that was the case where these appointed times don't apply to us, then you have to stop and think, well, wait a minute, these times, God really messed up in regard to these times. If God wanted to separate Jews from Christians, he could have chosen any other date. You know, but he chose, you know, Pentecost was a day that was part of Israel's heritage. And then as he began the church, the Pentecost was a day that was fundamental to Christians, as God established his church on that day. So God could have changed. He could have picked another day. But as you think about it, he didn't. He stuck with the way that he had planned it. And he gave them the Feast of Pentecost and all that it represents about the first fruits and about the, this is not the only day of salvation. So all of those things were in his mind as he kept the day of Pentecost and brought the church to the temple on the day of Pentecost and poured out his Spirit upon them. They received God's Spirit on Pentecost when that day was fully come. Or you might say that God waited until the appointed time. God waited until the appointed time to found his church and to pour his Spirit out. So God had already established Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, which mentions there would be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. The regular, reliable pattern of the sun and moon allowed for the determination of God's appointed times so that Pentecost could already be established back in Genesis. And God already planned the festivals way back in Genesis. And you can see that from the way the sun, moon, and stars line up. And we can say that when God created the lights in the firmament of the heavens, he built them into the creation itself. And as you go back to the Garden of Eden, how many Jews were there in the garden with Adam and Eve? Well, the simple answer to that is zero. There were no Jews. They were not a people at that point. And as you look at Adam and Eve, they were just people. They weren't Israelites or Jews or anything like that. So can we prove, you know, as you look at all of this, we can see that these things that we've looked at are hints. Are they proofs? Well, to me, they're pretty solid, but not everybody agrees with that. But as you look at it, boy, there are quite a few hints about the appointed times that God has given to you and me and to his people. So let's go to another scripture in Genesis, which is interesting to consider. In light of the days of unleavened bread, it gives us another hint. Genesis chapter 18, verse 1. Genesis chapter 18, verse 1. And so as you look at Genesis 18, we've moved forward in the story of God's people. And in Genesis 18, we're focused upon Abraham. And in Genesis 18, verse 1, it says, "Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth tree of Mamre as he was sitting in the door in the heat of the day." So as is typical in the Middle East, it was a hot day. And so people tend to try to find, you didn't have air conditioning, so people would sit in the shade and enjoy the shade. And that's what Abraham was doing. And he looks off into the distance and he sees these three men coming toward him. And he didn't, you know, they were at a distance, so he wasn't absolutely sure who it was who was coming, but he's looking out there and he sees them coming in his direction. Genesis 18, verse 12. Let's go down a little further in the chapter. Genesis chapter 18, verse 12. There it says, "So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him." So they've closed the distance and they're standing right by him. "And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground." So they arrive at his tent, and as he looks at them, he thinks he recognizes them, and as they've gotten closer, runs out to meet them, and he recognized two of the men as angels appearing as men, and the third man is actually God appearing as man. So this is actually Yahweh appearing as a man. So he recognizes him. Then let's go to Genesis 18, verse 3. "So Abraham said, 'My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servants. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet.'" It's interesting what happens here as you think about the bigger context. So they bring water to wash your feet. "And rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts, after you may pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant.' They said, 'Do as you have said.'" And so Abraham invites them into his tent. So he invites them into his tent. And then he runs back to his tent and tells Sarah in chapter 18, verse 6, he hurried into the tent and to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make cakes." So they were going to have to make cakes quickly, so there's no time for leavening any bread. So there, these whatever what the bread that we see being prepared here has to be unleavened. So Sarah is preparing unleavened bread. It doesn't say so, but that would only make sense because of the time. She's having to prepare this quickly. And so she could make unleavened bread quickly. She could bake it, and then you would have the bread available for the meal. And there was no time for the bread to rise. So we're not looking at the common bread that would rise and be baked. That's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at unleavened bread. As you think about this, well, it could have been unleavened bread. And just on, you know, with as you recognize that, that doesn't mean much to us. Doesn't mean much to us at all. It's only relevant because of what comes later in the story. It's only relevant because of what comes later in the story. One reason that God came down to the earth at that time was because he had been getting bad reports about the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and what was going on there. As it says in Genesis 18, verse 20, it says, "And the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it. It has come to me, that has come to me, and if not, I will know." So he was going to check it out himself. He wanted to see, he had heard reports from the angels about what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he wanted to verify what is in reality going on there. So he said, "I'll go down and I'll check it out." So he went down and there were two angels accompanying him. So God's been receiving these reports and he's come down to check out whether the reports are true. It goes on, and then we find the two angels leave God and Abraham and start walking down toward Sodom and Gomorrah. That leaves God and Abraham standing there alone. And God has a thought. He says to himself, "Should I hide from Abraham that which I am about to do?" Now, why would he care? Why is it important what's going to take place here? So what if it's hidden? Or did God have a plan that he wanted this, what's taking place here, and how he deals with it to be remembered by people? And it, so he adds two more things about to when he speaks to Abraham. He says, seeing that Abraham is going to be a great nation, that means he's going to have lots of descendants, lots of people will derive from Abraham. And Abraham will teach his children. The context makes it clear. If God destroys the city and nobody notes it, nobody makes note of it, then it will be destroyed and it will be a lesson for no one. So, and like he said, nobody on earth would know anything about it. But God wants it to be known. God wants it to be known because it's going to be good for people on the earth knowing about it. And so God knew Abraham, and he knew that he would be a great nation and that he would be a person who would teach his children. And so the story is going to be passed on and become known in the world. It would become known to Abraham and his family and spread from there to others. As you think about Western civilization, you've got about the population of the earth, you've got about 8 billion people. Out of those, you might say that a billion of them belong to the Western world, who would have some familiarity with the Bible or the Bible story about Sodom and Gomorrah. And a lot of people know that story. You look at what Peter has to say. He recounted it, and he recounts Noah, and he recounts what took place to Sodom and Gomorrah. And so these stories were known. They were common to the people of God. And so if my reasoning is correct, then God's decision to tell Abraham worked out to spread the story of Sodom far and wide in a much farther and wider way than it would have been otherwise. So now the two angels come down to Sodom, and who do they find sitting at the gate? Well, Lot. Lot was a leading man in the city, and there he is at the gate of the city. He notes Lot notes the two strangers entering the city, and he had no indication that they were angels at this point. So, and what does Lot do? According to Middle Eastern custom, he offered the two men coming into the town. He invites them to his house and invites them to stay with him and to eat with him. So he was extending Middle Eastern hospitality to these two strangers. The angels tell Lot, well, it's not really necessary for you to do this. We'll just sleep in the town square. And I think Lot knew that it would be a very poor decision to sleep in the town square because he knew the lack of character of the people in the city. So let's go to Genesis chapter 19, verse 3. Genesis chapter 19, verse 3. So the two angels are going to stay with Lot. So they agree to that. They're going to stay with him for the night. And as you look at Genesis chapter 19, verse 3, it's a rather enlightening verse and gives us another hint. Genesis 19, verse 3. It says, but he insisted strongly that the two angels stay with him. So they turned into him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. We might ask, well, why are the words unleavened bread included in the text? Why are they in there? Well, that probably goes back to Moses. Moses knew of this story because it had been passed along from Abraham to Jacob and Isaac and passed down through the generations, and it come down to Moses. And so Moses, writing down the scriptures, put that into the scriptures as well. And it was important that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah be made note of because it would be instructive to humanity. So Moses was inspired by God to make note of this story and to include it in the scriptures. And so Moses wrote down the scriptures for the people of Israel, and therefore that this story has been passed on from them down to our age and on beyond it. So Moses put all of this down, and these lessons were to be with Israel as they went forth from Egypt and went on down to the land of Canaan, where they would begin to practice the days of unleavened bread. God gave them that specific instruction, which we've looked at as we've gone through various aspects of the days of unleavened bread and the Passover. And as you look at unleavened bread, it adds a lot of legitimacy to the story of who the people are and where they've come from. And so it adds a lot to the story of Israel. Now, I mentioned that Moses said 400 years after Lot, Moses wasn't there. He wasn't there. So how does he know what happened? And you might think about, well, is Moses taking license? Did he really know about this? Remember, Moses saw God face to face for 40 years. So Moses had a very close relationship with God, and Moses had the best of all sources to tell the story because God was there for the entire history of Israel. And Moses, under God's inspiration, chose to put unleavened bread in the text. God knew what was going on, and he inspired Moses to write that down as part of the heritage of the people of Israel. Again, the mention of unleavened bread does not prove anything, but it is a hint that fits within the larger context. So we, you know, from what I can see, when it mentions unleavened bread, there's a purpose to it. It's not just something God throws in there for the fun of it. There's some point, some lesson that he wants to make. So we find that the two angels stayed with Lot, and that as they prepared a meal for them, unleavened bread was part of it. And in this context, we might remember the story of the book of Judges, where the Levite and his concubine passed through the territory of Benjamin. So it's a grisly story, but it just is quite representative of the time of the Judges. So in the context of the story, we might remember that in that book, the Levite and his concubine passed through the territory of Benjamin. And a man of Benjamin invited the two of them to stay with him for the night. Well, in the town where this Benjamite lived, there were some hoodlums and thugs who lived in the area, and they came up to this Benjamite's house and asked him to send out one of his two guests so that they could get to know them. Sadly, it's not talking about just getting to know them by chatting. It's talking about sexually bonding with them, which is, you know, a sick and perverted way of doing things. So anyway, they basically were asking them to send out these two people, and unfortunately, it ended with the death of the Levite's concubine, and that's put into God's word, and the angels visiting Sodom and staying with Lot are sending up on the spot reports of the wickedness of the place, and obviously this town in Benjamin was wicked, and they would pay the price for what they did. So why did God come down when he did? God could have come down to the earth 6 months earlier, or he could have come down 6 months later. Why did he choose to come at the particular time that he did? The hint in the story is that he came down at an appointed time. At an appointed time. And what appointed time did he come down? He came down at the time of the days of unleavened bread. And just as we are putting out sin from our homes at the time of unleavened bread, God came down to the earth to put out an exceptional form of sin, to end such an abominable sin off the face of the earth. And these are hints around the whole story, but they do fit in with the days of unleavened bread. So why did God do that? Why did he do it that way? Paul tells us in the New Testament, speaking of normal bread, a little leaven leavens the entire lump. So we find that it appears God came down to the earth, and one of the contaminants that could easily spread was removed. And so God ended up sending fire and brimstone down to eliminate the people who were involved in what was going on there in Sodom. And basically, he cauterized that part of the earth so the sin did not go any further. He brought it to an end with fire and brimstone. So as you look at the scriptures, there's a second hint of unleavened bread in Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. And before we read the passage, let me set up the stage for you. So Israel learns about the days of unleavened bread as they are coming out of Egypt. And I'm not even sure Moses knows about the days of unleavened bread at this point, because God hasn't revealed those days to Moses or to Israel. So God tells Moses, you go say this to Pharaoh. You go say this to Pharaoh. And here is the clue about something going on. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1. There it says, "Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast or a festival to me in the wilderness.'" Well, what festival could he be talking about? God wanted them to go into the wilderness to hold a festival, to hold a festival. And what festival could we be talking about? Interestingly, the festivals haven't even been revealed yet. So we find that they are about to be delivered on the Passover. And the idea is that God has come down on one of his appointed times, both to deliver Israel, and he wants them to observe a festival. And the only festival around Passover time are the Days of Unleavened Bread. The Days of Unleavened Bread are the festival days that are around Passover. So as you look at that, you see that God wanted them to go into the wilderness and keep a festival. And what festival was close to the time in which this is unfolding? Now let's go to the New Testament. Let's go to the New Testament and look at a few hints we have over there. So in the New Testament, we come to the very last week of Jesus's life. He only has a few more hours of life remaining. And we know that story. He visits the temple. And what does he find in the temple as he visits it? So this is near the end of his life. And what does he find? He finds people selling cattle, sheep, doves. All three animals are used in the sacrificial system. So they're selling all these animals. And Jesus finds others sitting at money-changing tables. And why are they there? Well, if you're going to buy an animal for sacrifice, you're going to need money to pay for it. And so the money had to be specific. And so it was a way that they could exchange money for whatever currency they had from where they were from. And then they could take that money and they could buy what they needed for sacrifice. So they're making money through the sale of animals and through money exchange. And remember Acts chapter 2 at the day of Pentecost. Remember that there were a huge number of people coming into the temple. The Bible tells us that there were 17 different nations mentioned in Acts chapter 2. And they speak different languages. They have money in different forms, depending on the nation. And when they come to Israel, they have to change money into the local currency. And so if you want to buy an animal, you need the local currency in order to make the purchase, or to pay the temple tax, you need the local currency as well. So they would exchange their money for money that was considered appropriate for the purchase of the animals or to make an offering to the temple. So you find people standing in line to make their purchase, and basically what was happening in the part of the temple is that it had been made a stockyard. So you've got all these animals, they're going to the bathroom. You have them with all of their making all of the bleating, the mooing, and the sounds that are common to those animals. And you have them go, as I said, going to the bathroom. So when you have them going to the bathroom, then you have the flies and other insects coming around, and it's not a and the odors that go with it. So it's not an overly pleasant experience, but they were a lot more used to it than we would be. So we find Christ observing all of this. and beginning to do something. Christ stooped down and he fashioned a whip. I'm not sure what he used, but he fashioned a whip. And as you think about it, he's got a whip in his hand. And we might think, well, I thought he was supposed to be meek and mild. Well, I think he was, but he needed something to drive the cattle. As you think about cattle, and I don't know a lot about cattle, I just know what I've heard about cattle. And when cattle are around human beings, people many times treat their cattle like pets. And so the cattle become somewhat tame. You feed them, you water them, you pet them. And as they're cared for, you know, when you want them to move, they're not going to move. They'll just stay right in that position. So you can yell at them. You can try to poke them, but it's hard to get them to move. So that's why it talks about in the scriptures about a goad by which you would poke the ox to keep the ox moving. And so Christ made a whip in order to drive the cattle. And sheep, he wanted them to move out of the temple. And so he's driving these animals out of the temple, and he's overturning the money changers' tables. And this was something shocking to the money changers and others there who were running a business. And because of all of the people in Jerusalem, they were doing quite well financially. You know, as Christ began to overturn the tables, you can imagine that they've been doing a land office business and they've got quite a bit of money stacked up on the tables, and he's overturning it and coins are going everywhere. So as this is going on, he's driving the animals out of the temple. He's overturned the money changers' table, and people are scurrying to get out of the way, to get out of out of the temple in order to escape Christ with the whip. So anyway, they're trying to get out. Interestingly, you had people that showed up at the temple who brought their goods, and they were trying to bring them into the temple. And when they saw that Christ is driving people out with this whip, they probably changed their mind and thought, this may not be such a good idea to go into the temple at this time. So as you think about what Jesus is doing, what do you think Christ was doing at the time? Was he doing something that would have fit in with the season that they were in, that would fit in with, for example, cleaning and for the days of unleavened bread? So as you're a couple of days from Passover, and the Jews were removing the leaven and out of their homes, they were cleansing their homes, and that's what Christ was doing. He was cleansing his Father's house. He was cleansing his Father's house, and they're taking the leaven, the type of sin, out of their houses, and Christ was doing the same in his house. He was cleansing his Father's house a couple of days before unleavened bread. Look at what Jesus does. It is written, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves." So Jesus was cleaning out his Father's house, cleaning out his Father's house. Now, so you can see, you know, it doesn't specifically talk about unleavened bread, but you can look at the time that we're in with the Passover coming up, and right on its heels, the days of unleavened bread. So you can see how there would be a clear tie-in. And as you think of what Christ is doing in driving out the animals and the money changers and all of that, then he was cleansing the temple in order to bring it back to a standard that would be pleasing to God. So with that in mind, let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And as we get into that, I'll set up what's going on there. And then we'll look at a few passages in 1 Corinthians 5. So as you think about 1 Corinthians, scholars agree that 1 Corinthians was written before the days of unleavened bread. So the Corinthians would be better, would get the letter during the days of unleavened bread. Or it's possible that Paul wrote it right during the days of unleavened bread. As you think about the scholars, they don't keep the days of unleavened bread. They don't really understand fully what's going on here. They might even make note that it was during the Passover and the holy times for the people of Judah. But, you know, we can look at 1 Corinthians and we can see some interesting wording there that signals to us what's going on and what time it is. We find words like lump. We find old lump. We find become a new lump. We find words like you are puffed up, like bread. I want you to become unleavened. And finally, he says, let us keep the feast of unleavened bread. He says that straight out. Paul tells them clearly to keep the feast of unleavened bread. And we, having some understanding, having kept the days of unleavened bread for a while, we know what he's talking about there. It's not something that is hidden to us. But I would say for most people from the scholarly community, it's not an overly significant thing, or it's just seen as something that took place, but it has no real application to us in modern times. So as you think about him talking about these things, to the congregation in Corinth, you got to stop and think, well, wait a minute, what background were these people as far as God's way of life? Were they Jews or were they Gentiles? The majority of them were Gentiles. So this clearly indicates that Paul was teaching them about the days of unleavened bread and the other holy days. These weren't things that they normally did as people living in Corinth. These are things that they had begun to do because they had been taught to do them. Paul had come there and shown them these things, and so clearly they were keeping the days of unleavened bread and had some familiarity with the various markers that would tell us that he's talking about the days of unleavened bread. For instance, if you look at the British scholar of the Bible, Conybeare, he says it is evident from all the words used by Paul in 1 Corinthians that the church was being taught by Paul to keep the days of unleavened bread. And that's significant because how much time has passed since the death of Jesus Christ? Okay, in actuality, 25 years have passed since Christ was crucified. And here you find a church of God, a predominantly Gentile background church, keeping the days of unleavened bread, keeping the Passover, because as you go on later in the book of 1 Corinthians, it clearly talks about the Passover and the right approach to keeping the Passover. So that's something interesting to keep in mind. Why be talking about these things if it has no application? Then let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, because 1 Corinthians 5 lays out an issue that helps us to understand what time of the year it was and what the people of Corinth needed to do to resolve the issue. In the church in 1 Corinthians 5, we find that there was a man who was sleeping with his father's wife. She would probably be considered his stepmother. And was that a problem as far as godly conduct? Well, yes, it was. You go back to Leviticus 18, verse 8, it tells us that this was inappropriate behavior for a follower of God. So Paul says that what this man was doing was so grotesque that not even the Gentiles would indulge in such a practice. I think it's important to point out that this was not a private sin. But it was a sin that was known throughout the church. Everybody knew about it. Everybody knew about it. It wasn't private. So because it wasn't private, then you had to deal with it in a manner that addressed everybody. You wouldn't just keep it quiet. You wouldn't hush it up. You would have to deal with it. So everybody knew that this was not to be tolerated and the person was going to be dealt with. Now, so these, and the people in Corinth, unfortunately, were aware of this going on. And Paul says, you guys don't understand. You're tolerating this, and it's inappropriate for you to be tolerating sin. So you need to ask this fellow not to attend church. And Paul realized that this extreme measure would have to take place. And he felt bad about doing it, but he also looked at what is going to be best for the long-term progress of these people whom God has called and is working with. It's not, you cannot tolerate sin, because as you as the leadership of the church tolerate sin, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And Paul was not willing to do that. So they're told to purge out the old leaven in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7, that you may be a new lump, since you are unleavened. They were unleavened because they had put the leaven out of their houses. And they were to purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump. Because this is 25 years after Christ's death, we have to conclude that the day of unleavened bread, days of unleavened bread, were not just for Jews. As you look at what takes place in Genesis chapter 1, there were no Jews. When it talks about these holy days and holy times, these appointed times, they would apply to all people, not just the people that God was calling. God intended them for all people, and eventually they will be for all people. So in this study, we've examined hints about the days of unleavened bread that we find in the Bible. So we've looked at Genesis 1, verse 14, where the appointed times are spoken of. We find that the text goes out of its way to tell us that Lot made a feast of unleavened bread for the two angels who are going to stay the night with him. And we find a strong case that God came down during the days of unleavened bread to destroy the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. And finally, we find that Jesus Christ cleaned the sin out of the temple at the same time as the Jews were taking leavened bread out of their homes. And finally, we find that the Apostle Paul was urging Gentile Christians to become spiritually unleavened as a church, even as they were already unleavened physically. So we find the days of unleavened bread were given for all mankind. And as we go through the scriptures, we can find various hints in there, maybe not direct statements. We can find those hints, which put together, to me, lends a credence to the importance of the days of unleavened bread. It's not something that you can just say, well, who cares? It's not important. It's very important. And we are reminded by this that we continue to keep the days of unleavened bread because they are significant to God, and they should be significant to all of us. So I know that we're coming up on the Passover, but I still felt it would be worthwhile to look at this particular subject, which is interesting because it's basically you're getting hints and allusions to the days of unleavened bread, maybe not so much direct statements about it. So I hope that you found it profitable. I found it profitable preparing the study. So thank you for your attention.